We've asked Sach Dasa to come along to talk about wheel making in general. He doesn't work for us or anything like that, and he's not going to be trying to encourage you to make a legacy for the Environment Trust, so just to get that clear. And obviously a number of you probably have already made a wheel, maybe you're thinking about if you want to tweak it or whatever, we'll find that out. I could just say very briefly my own experience of after I made a will. I made a homemade one to begin with from a Woolworths, that tells you how long ago it was, a Woolworths kind of, you know, do-it-yourself form, and got a couple of mates to sign it. And then it was quite a lot later that I thought, no, I'll go to a solicitor and get a different one. And I didn't estimate how much of a relief and how good I'd feel about that. And even though I did that 5 years ago, I still feel good about the fact that that's actually sorted. And actually, it wasn't a difficult process. And it seems most of us overestimate the time and effort involved in making a will. And actually, we underestimate how much we've got to give away. So, yeah, it'll be an interesting session. And thank you very much for coming along, and I'll hand you over to Sach Dasa.
Thanks very much, Tara Darkany. Yeah, my name is Sach Dasa, and I've been writing wills for about 5 years now. I mainly write wills for people in Triratna, Mitra's friends, order members, their families. Occasionally other people contact me. I do wills for anyone. but I started writing wills after my friend Mahananda died. Well, I wrote my first will for him before we went travelling, and I am a trained solicitor. I'm non-practising now, but I thought, well, I'll write him a will. And he died, and he left an enormous legacy to the London Buddhist Centre, which has transformed into Vajrasana, into the new retreat centre. And he didn't have a will, and he was in his early 60s, and he had a property, So that was an inspiration to think, well, this is a really good thing to do, to write wills. But actually, more than that, it's become I enjoy it. I think it's a lovely way that I've had of connecting with people, finding out about what they want and how to help them do the best will that's possible. People often talk about a valid will. You know, there's lots of legal technicalities involved in will writing. But it's also important to write a good will that really actually is right for now and that thinks a little way into the future, what might happen. Trying to account for certain eventualities, maybe looking at more complex issues to do with trusts and tax, which I will just touch on. But you have to keep reviewing your will, you have to keep coming back to it. Life changes, and it can, over the period of 10 years, as I'm sure you know, things can change hugely. So you always need to keep coming back to a will. So what I thought I would do is to just say a few things that are common types of considerations to do with wills generally. They may or may not apply to you. You may get some ideas. After I've done that, then we'll open up to questions where you can say, yeah, but what about this? This is because wills are always come down to quite specific personal questions. So a little bit first to say about the motivation to write a will and what I've seen. Some people are very good Buddhists, and they remember that Padmasambhava says that turning your mind to impermanence is the method without which no means exists. And Buddhists are generally pretty good at just saying, well, actually, it's a reasonable thing to do. I am going to die. I will get a will. But probably most people, including Buddhists, come when something happens. So that can be getting married, getting divorced, having a child and wanting to protect the interests of your child, and maybe appoint a guardian in a will. That's quite a common motivation for younger people to write wills. When you retire, that's the time when people start thinking about wills and in terms of their property and passing it on in an efficient way. And another thing will be obviously illness, one's own illness or the death or illness of a loved one. And then, of course, you know, there's the time when we really are actually facing the prospect of death, or when we feel ourselves to be in that position. So there's lots of reasons why. And your will is said to be, they call it ambulatory, it walks alongside you. It's not actually, doesn't do anything, your will, until you die. But the last one that you've written, the last dated one, you should tear up all the previous ones. The last one is deemed to be your wish just before you die, in that second before you die. That's why it's your last will. There are many good reasons to write a will, which are kind of obvious. You know, if you don't write a will, you're intestate. And the law presumes certain things about your wishes. It just says, well, we presume you would want to give such and such to your spouse if you have a spouse, such and such to your children. So it will do it for you, but it very often it won't do it exactly what you would have wanted. And sometimes it will do quite a lot that you don't want. So there's a good reason to have a will in terms of giving to your family, giving to your friends, and things that you value. It's a chance when you write a will to consider Well, often people find that quite a challenging question. Who would I leave my money to? Maybe there's not an obvious place to give it. And then one has to start looking at what one values, what causes one wants to support in that way. They are can be very valuable documents. It might be the most valuable document that you write in your life, you will. And the other thing is that it, from a spiritual point of view, you might see an opportunity to give things away to your children, to causes. You know, you might assess that that's actually a good thing to do from a number of points of view, is to simplify your life a little bit. But I think also just having the conversation that wills bring up with the people close to you, having that conversation is really, really important. I'll say a bit more about that. I suppose ultimately, and I think of this in the case of my friend Mahananda, you might die suddenly. It does happen, as we all know. We might think it isn't going to happen to us, but you might suddenly find yourself like Mahananda. He had a stroke and he wasn't found until it was too late. He was unconscious and he died within the space of 24 hours from having no apparent effect to being dead. And if he hadn't done his will, I can imagine that there might have been a time when that would have been really on his mind, that he hadn't done the practical things. There are probably a lot of other things on one's mind when one's dying, you know. But getting that basic level of things sorted out, you know, those things are things that we can do with a will. So that's why to write one. I'm sure you're all convinced about that. So I'll say a bit about executors, and then I'll say something about the types of gifts. Then I'll talk about charities and giving to charities and family in wills. I'll say a little bit about trusts, the use of trusts. A little bit about inheritance tax until your eyes start drooping. And I'll touch on the question of living wills and lasting powers of attorney, just to kind of disambiguate those terms so we can see what they mean. I'll just touch on that. I won't be going into a huge amount of detail. So executors and trustees, who do we choose? What are they? So an executor is the person who has the legal responsibility for enacting what it says in your will. All your property notionally belongs to your executor after you've died, and they execute your wishes and give out your property. It might mean they have to open a bank account and to take your property in. Sometimes, more often than not, people will employ a solicitor to act for them, or the solicitor will be the executor. But you don't have to employ a solicitor or a professional. You can do it yourself if you've got the stomach for all the tax forms and documents. And what you enter into is a process called probate. Sometimes if people's estates are over a certain amount or they contain certain items, you have to get what's called a grant of probate. So that's what an executor does. That grant of probate allows the executor to write to your bank, write to the land registry, start changing around titles, documents, and doing all the things that need to be done. So your executor should ideally be either a professional or a mixture of professional, or it could just be your spouse or your children. That's the most common thing. Might be that you add a solicitor in there as well. You might have a reserve person to act if those people can't act. It could be a friend. That's very common. And a lot of the wills I do, I appoint my partner, my spouse, and my friend, or I appoint my two friends. And it might be that there are different types of people to look after different interests that we have. So it might be that there's a trust in your will for your family, but you're also giving something to a charity and you want a friend in who might carry that a little bit, that interest. But it's a position of trust, so essentially you appoint someone you trust, usually at least two people. So there are types of gifts that you can give by will. They could be your things called chattels. This is a chattel, this bottle of elderflower cordial. Your car is a chattel, a computer is a chattel, books. There's a long list of things that are considered chattels. It doesn't include your money and it doesn't include real estate. And obviously it's a bit difficult to know what you might have to give away in 25 years or whenever you die. Our possessions pass through us quite a lot there. So you can just write a letter that you leave with your will that directs it more informally. It's not a legal thing, but it's a wish. So you might give everything to your executors and then let them dish things out according to this more informal letter, which you can then change. If you have specific items like family heirlooms, jewellery, or works of art, or things you definitely will, you know, you're pretty sure you'll keep and you want to go somewhere, you can mention them specifically in a will as well. But keeping it out the will means you don't have to change every time you change your possessions. The other types of gifts are money gifts, gifts of specific amounts. People often leave something to their executors for being executors, if you like. specific amounts to friends, family members, nieces and nephews, this kind of thing. With those gifts, it's quite important to say, well, what would happen if that person died before you? Would it go to their children, if they have any children, or would it not? Would it go to somebody else, or would it go to a charity, or would it go into the third category of gift, which is called your residue? So the residuary gift is the third type of gift, which is everything that's left over in your estate after your things, your chattels have been given away, after your money gifts have been given away, after you've paid your debts and your testamentary funeral expenses, that's all been paid, then the residue is what's left over. And that's usually divided into percentages. So it might be that I give all my residue to my children. I give 50% of my residue to such and such person. 50% is to be divided between these three charities. Or so you divide it in any way you can. Again, the really important thing, and what people don't always think about, quite understandably, is what happens if the person you gave 50% to dies before you. So that's where you can get problems in wills. It just doesn't say what happens then. So you should really all tie it up. And ideally, you have a kind of a charity right at the bottom, which is if everybody dies, if there's some calamity or other, which is quite difficult to think about, but, you know, some kind of big pile-up or something, you can have a charity there, which is much less likely to not be there. So those are the kinds of gifts and the kind of rundown of gifts through a will. That's what a will looks like. There's loads of other things that can go in will, as I've said, guardianship, funeral wishes, and many more technical things, but that's enough for now. Yeah, I just want to touch on charities and families. So we've heard a bit about charitable giving today and families. So in this country, you can give to whomever you wish. That's the sort of basic rule. It's not the case in all countries. In many countries, you have property. You can't give it away by will. It just goes automatically to certain classes of people, most obviously family members. That's not the case in this country, although there is an Act of Parliament which says that certain classes of family members and dependents, if they're not provided for in a will, they can make a claim against an estate. And this is sort of a little bit of a growing area of law. It applies to spouses, certainly applies to children who are below university age or, you know, needing that kind of support. It can apply to other people as well, and sometimes even adult children have managed to make effective claims. So what I would say is, and this is a, you know, standard advice, is that you must consider all the people who you reasonably ought to consider. And ideally, you should talk to them. And if you don't plan to leave your children, say, everything equally between them, you certainly be well advised to not create a big shock for them a bit further down the line. So talk about things. So you don't necessarily have to do everything in a particular way, but it's good to have the discussion. It's good to write down why you've decided to do things the way that you've done them, just so that there is a record of that. And really consider all of the people that you ought to consider when you're writing a will. But I think the key thing is to talk to family. I mean, there are lots of arguments among families when the wills, and typically between siblings, things can get very messy. And some of those are not avoidable. Not avoidable in terms of a will, but a well-written will where you've spoken to people beforehand is possibly the best way of avoiding the unpleasantness of there being a dispute. Because it's very unpleasant, obviously, if there's a dispute. And it's very costly if anybody tries to challenge your will. It really is disastrous, actually. So that's charities and families. Yes, because sometimes people give everything to the dog's home or whatever, and then children feel a bit unhappy about that. So, yeah, you need to think about all that very carefully. Okay. Trusts. This is where your eyelids may droop, but basically a lot of people use trusts now, and they're to avoid three problems, probably more, but I'll just concentrate on it. One is sideways disinheritance. The other is the fact of care home fees. The thirdly is beneficiaries who are in difficulty and who you wouldn't want to give money directly to. So you can use trusts for all of these things. Sideways disinheritance is if a couple break up, they have children, and then they get remarried. Their spouse has children from their first marriage. Very common. And unless you're careful, the money goes by intestacy to the second spouse and then passes straight down to their children when the second spouse dies. That's sideways disinheritance. It happens a lot. So really, then you want to put a trust into your will so that the money can be protected for the benefit of your second spouse, second partner, for their life, so they can draw income or use a house. But then ultimately, when you die, that money is protected and it goes to your children or however you wish. And then the other thing is care home fees that some people think about. When you die, your money might go directly to your survivor. That would be quite normal. It happens a lot. Everything passes to my wife or my partner. But if they then need care home fees, if they need long-term residential care, the money which the local authority is allowed to sort of claim will include everything that you've given them. Whereas if you put that into a trust, the money that the local authority can claim will only be whatever it is that they own themselves, not what's in the trust. The trust will be preserved. The capital of the trust will be preserved, again, in order to go to your ultimate beneficiaries, which may be your children or someone else. If they need care, you can use that money as well to help them with that, so it's not like you're stopping that possibility. So that's very common. People talk about that a lot in wills. And that's quite legitimate. It's your money that you've given to your loved one. You just want it to be protected a bit for your ultimate beneficiaries. And the third reason for deploying trusts is if your children or person you want to give to has maybe a drug problem, or you're worried that they might be going through a divorce or bankrupt, you don't necessarily want to give the money directly to them. You give them into a discretionary trust, which allows the trustees to give to them, but only in ways which maybe are helpful to that person. And you can direct the trustee how that might happen. So they're kind of a bit protective trusts, and they're very common in wills. Okay, so time's moving on, so I won't say too much about inheritance tax. Maybe that will come up in the discussion, in the questions and answers. But loosely speaking, if you have more than 325,000, or as a husband and wife or civil partners, you have more than 650,000, you're going to start paying inheritance tax on anything that you don't give either to each other or to charities. So anything you leave to each other is free of inheritance tax. Anything to charities is free of inheritance tax. But then inheritance tax kicks in, and it's about 40% of whatever's left over that. It's much more technical than that, but that's just the basics. So finally, while you're still alive, that's when you're dead. No, while you're still alive, there are other things to consider. So while you're still alive, we sometimes fear losing our mental capacity or not being able to make decisions for ourselves. So there are two things that people talk about. One is called a living will. It's more properly called a medical directive or an advanced medical directive. This is a sheet of paper, really, where you say that in the event where I have lost my capacity, my mental capacity, I can't communicate, and I'm in an incurable medical condition defined in some way that is going to leave me unable to do anything in the doctor's opinion, then I wouldn't wish to have treatment. Usually people say, oh, I wouldn't wish to have treatment which is merely designed to keep me alive. Yes, I would like treatment which keeps me comfortable, but I wouldn't like just ongoing treatment of that kind. Some people say, I'd like it to keep going as long as possible, please. That's another living will. Okay, so that's one model, which is where you are saying, this is my decision. And it's a piece of paper that the doctors will read, and theoretically they're bound to sort of honour that. I'll come back to why that might be a bit difficult in a minute. The other version is called a lasting power of attorney. So there's two types, one for health and welfare decisions, and one for finance and property decisions. These are people who you appoint to act on your behalf when you haven't the capacity to act for yourself. With finance and property decisions, actually, it could just be that you're ill and you can't get out to the bank, but you haven't lost your mental capacity. Or it might be that once your capacity is faltering or intermittent, or when you've finally really lost your capacity, these documents can be very useful for moving house, for selling property, for operating bank accounts, all the things that people ask you for your identification for. So that's that. And then the health and welfare covers all sorts of non-life-threatening situations where you have treatment regimes. All that would be discussed with your attorney or attorneys, usually 2, 3, 4 attorneys. Again, they're like your executives, they're people you trust, they're usually family members, people very close to you, friends, close friends. And then it can also include giving or refusing consent to life-sustaining treatment type decisions. Now, the lasting power of attorney regime in health matters, I think, is a bit more complete because it covers all sorts of decisions, not just the last, final sorts of withdrawing treatment considerations. It also gives the people who know you, who you trust, it gives them a say, gives them some discretion to act in accordance with how the situation actually is. And living wills are a little bit uncertain as to whether the doctors really want to pay attention to those documents, because ultimately they may not be sure, well, you signed that document 7 years ago, but what do you think now, given the state of medical science now, and all the things that now apply, which you couldn't really have known 7 years ago. So, and there might be your loved ones standing around who have different ideas. So they can put doctors in a bit of a difficult situation, and they might just not agree to apply them. I have heard... Yes, they can legally do that, because ultimately they decide whether a living will is applicable in some ways by deciding whether the medical facts actually apply. I have heard that they're not terribly popular living wills with the medical profession, whereas a power of attorney actually says, these are my attorneys, I've chosen them. Ultimately, they've got this weight of being able to make that sort of decision. The doctors, of course, will do exactly, you know, according to their own oaths, and look after their patients according to their own ethics and procedures. But once they've run out of that line of inquiry, it's quite good for them to be able to turn to an attorney and say, well, what do you think? Of course, they would also turn to a spouse, even if they weren't attorneys, but it gives a little bit more weight to the whole thing. So those are the two differences, living wills and powers of attorney. They're not wills at all. That's while you're still alive. There's a whole procedure for registering lasting powers of attorney, and I won't go into that now, but let's have some questions and answers, or questions at least, okay? Yeah, it's a question about how should we store the will, and does it have to be with a solicitor or a bank? The main thing is that your will is locatable after you've died, and it's safe. At some point, we've probably done it for other people, there will be that moment where somebody says of us, did they write a will, and where is it? And quite often it's pretty hard to locate a will. You'd be surprised that, you know, we move house, we move around, and things just get, you know, and it's not obvious. So one of the benefits of storing it externally is that it's probably safer, although there are stories about things getting lost in bank vaults and things like that. Solicitors like to have wills because they're a very valuable source of income in terms of probate. Once they've got you over to get your will, they'll try and sell you their services to do probate, which is fair enough. So the straightforward answer is that if you can store your will safely, you can store your will. There's no legal obligation to give it to anyone. But the main thing is that it's safe. Generally, we only produce one copy of a will. People say, well, why don't you have two or three, you know, four or ten, you know, so I'll give one to my family. You don't want to do that because you might change your will and then you have to get them all back in and tear them all up. It creates dreadful confusion. So generally you have one will, just keep it safe. That's your main thing. The question is, are there any Buddhist centres storing wills for a small fee? I'm not aware of that. I store them myself for a small fee. So, yeah, I'm aware of one person that does that. And I know that there are Buddhist centres who do store things in their safe. Again, you want to check that that is actually safe, because I get a bit worried about it. You know, it might just be that they're slipped in alongside the NatWest paying in slips or whatever. There's a bunch of wills there in an envelope. And recently I retrieved one. I asked somebody to retrieve one from the basement at Ashtana just after they'd moved in. They said, oh, we know there's a box of wills here somewhere. We got it out. Somebody had died and an order member had died. And thankfully it was still there. It was 25 years old. Was written in basement somewhere in Pamaloka or London Buddhist Centre somewhere. It was all completely out of date. It took 4 years before we managed to get that. There were lots of reasons why he didn't even live in England now, and it was quite a tricky one. But it's not ideal to just leave things willy-nilly, really. Do be careful about where you leave your will. Yes, so if a solicitor holds your will, they may be the executors. If you've gone to a solicitor, they'll probably suggest that you put them as executors, and maybe your family will be in there as well as executors, and in which case it would make sense that they then have the will because they are already executors. But if they're not executors, then they will try to help you, and that's a service that solicitors offer. Usually wills are, you know, reasonably inexpensive, at least a basic will. If it has trust, it's always more. And I will say that sometimes people get charged horrendous amounts for lasting powers of attorney. But when you die, then solicitors usually charge a percentage of the value of your estate as the basis for probate, basically sorting everything out after someone's died, which is often quite a lot to sort out. It does take some months, even in simple cases. If they're not an executor, they help you. They just do all the work. They don't need to be the executor, but very often they are as well. But you as an executor employ them to do all the stuff you don't have a clue how to do. The question is, if you don't have too much money or property, is it worth going to see a solicitor, or would it be okay just to use one of the ones they have in WH Smith or Woolworths when there was such a thing? There is still such a thing as WH Smith. I mean, Basically, I've seen some of these wills you get in WH Smith. They say it's a really simple thing to write a will, but then you look on the back and there's a huge, long sort of thing to read through, which actually looks quite complicated, to be honest. The short answer is you can write your own will. It's not illegal. It's perfectly justifiable to write your own will. But there is a good argument for going to see either a solicitor or a will writer who is insured with a will writing body like the Society of Will Writers or the Institute of Professional Will Writers. There's a good argument for going to see them, even if you don't have much money. And the argument is you don't know how much money you're going to have when you die. Nobody actually knows that. The other thing is, the thing about employing someone to help you is that you get more clarity and more certainty about what you've written. There are things which you won't know that you don't know about the whole process. You know, if it's a question of, you know, you really don't have very much and you just can't afford it, you can write a will. I mean, most will writers would just look at that and say, yeah, it's valid, fine, wouldn't charge for that. I wouldn't charge just to look at someone's will and say it was a valid will. I don't want to sort of dismiss the homemade will idea, but certainly if you've got property, if you've got a reasonable amount of money, I would say it's not a very good idea. It's not a great deal that you have to pay to get someone to write a will compared to the amount of money and the sort of the sense of clarity. You know, if you don't employ someone, you're often feeling, did I get that right? Am I doing this right? And you'll just live with that slight doubt. I've heard the statistics are something like there are more mistakes in homemade wills than in any other type of will. But there are still mistakes in wills written by solicitors and will writers that equal. Okay, so the question is about having assets in the US or in Europe or abroad generally. Yes, there's lots to say about that. The general rule is that if you have real estate in another country, you're advised to make a will in that country. That would be the basic principle. And you make a will that just applies to the property in that country. And then you have your will in the UK, which applies to everything else. And you have to be very careful that those two wills don't conflict with each other. The other thing is that in Europe, there is the possibility of, and this has only just come in, it's a couple of years old, where you can specify the laws of which country apply to your whole estate, whether it's in Europe or whichever country in Europe you're in. This is really quite complicated, and it would need to be looked into which countries and were they signatories to this act. Because the difficulty with European properties like France and Spain classically is that you could say I give away my flat in Spain, but then of course in Spain actually there are laws which say it has to go to certain people, you can't pass it by your will. It's a more complex picture than that. The cross-border aspects need quite a lot of looking into. The general rule is if you have real estate, it's best to, it's quicker as well, because when you have a document that's in English and you have to prove it, that's what probate means, when you have to prove it through the Spanish legal system, you have to get it translated, you have to get it sort of notarized, it's quite a complex process, whereas if you have a Spanish will, they get what that is, they know what that is, they'll deal with it much easier. So there are practical as well as legal considerations. This is a question to summarize about what are called life interest trusts. Mm-hmm. And they can do some of the things that I spoke about trust doing earlier, but to look at it from the point of view of what usually is the case is a you have a partner, you wish them to be able to live in the house or holiday house or enjoy the rental income from a rental property or whatever it is. So you just pass that property into a life interest trust, which creates what's called a life tenant, which could be your partner. They're usually allowed, guaranteed the income or the residency in that property for the rest of their lives or for a specified period of time, like until they move in with somebody else. Usually it's more generously, it's for life. Or until they renounce it, they're not interested in it. But they're not entitled to the capital. So they might be able to move house even, you know, but then the trust property changes to the new house. And then when they die, the property is then divided between what would be called your ultimate beneficiaries. Some trusts can also give the life tenant a discretionary interest in the capital of the property as well. You can also give your partner the right to have, say they really desperately needed to liquidate that house and use the money to pay for their care or something, you know, you can put that kind of a provision in. The question is, if two partners were making life interest trusts, would everything go into the same trust? What they are is two trusts in a will. So usually the partners' spouses or partners' wills will reflect each other. So there'd be a life interest trust. Say they own 50% of the property each. One would give her 50% of the property into a trust. Yeah, and he would, or her, or whoever it is, would give their 50% into a trust when they die. Of course, when the survivor dies, there's no need for a trust because there's no life interest. So when the survivor dies, the money would go straight to the ultimate beneficiaries. It wouldn't go into the same trust. It might do if it was a discretionary trust, but it can go in both two directions. Yeah, so that's why it's very useful if you have different ultimate beneficiaries, if you each have different children, you know. So a question about whether the life interest trust has to be in the will. Yes, it does. Yes, it's all written into the will, but it doesn't take effect until you die. So you haven't actually done anything if it's a trust in a will. There's a trust that you can write in your life. You can move property into trusts, and many people do this for all sorts of reasons while they're alive. But this is in a will, so the will only has effect when you die. So the trust springs into existence. What it is just called a life interest trust. It means your executors normally are trustees as well. They're called trustees. And if it was a house, say 50% of the house would be transferred into the name of my executors. They would hold it on trust, which just means that you would trust them to hold it according to what it says in my will for the benefit of my wife, my partner, whatever. The address wouldn't matter. The key thing would be the number, the charity registration number. If that's in there, that doesn't usually change. I'd always put the charity number in a will because charities do change their names occasionally, do move. If a charity is actually no longer existent, there's a clause in a will normally that says, I give my trustees the discretion to give it to a trust with similar aims, a charity with similar aims, if that one doesn't exist. If you give a lot of money, I will say there's one good thing about if you've got loads of money and you give at least 10% of your estate to charity, your inheritance tax goes down from 40% to 36%. And that amount which is chargeable to inheritance tax goes down. That's a little incentive. So this is a question about gift aid in relation to property given by will. The answer is that the gift aid regime doesn't apply to property given by will. That's only to income. If you left cash to a property, the tax benefit is that you don't pay any inheritance tax on that money. So your estate doesn't have to pay 40%. If you gave £100,000 to the RSPB and then you had another £300,000 in your estate, you wouldn't pay any inheritance tax at all. Whereas if you had £400,000 in your estate and you didn't give any to charity, theoretically, all other things being equal, £75,000 of that would be chargeable at 40%. Yeah, so this is about people challenging a will in which they have not been included or they feel they have not been included sufficiently. This is something that if you're not included in a will, the law allows for certain classes of people to demand money from an estate. And obviously that's a matter that the courts have to get involved in. It's a contentious matter. So there will be a negotiation probably, and it might be able to be settled amicably. But if it's not settled amicably, then it would have to go to court. And the courts then make a judgment about what is reasonable in all the circumstances to give to this spouse. You know, it might be somebody you haven't lived with for years, but still you're still married or something, or children, or, you know, they have a whole way of deciding what it is. A bit like a divorce or something like that. There's a whole set of thoughts that they go through about what kinds of things are relevant. It will be all sorts of things: size of your estate, the relative wealth of all the parties, what their needs are. They'll go into everything to decide. So it can be quite expensive because you have to pay lawyers. Yeah, well, somebody would have to pay for all those lawyers' fees, yeah. And I mean, ultimately, that would probably be the beneficiaries who are defending the case would have to pay from somewhere. So yeah, obviously, any kind of dispute after someone's died just deepens whatever family sangskaras there are around. You know, they really can get entrenched and bitter. But people can come to amicable agreements. That's one thing I suppose you should say, is that if you don't like what's written in a will, and, you know, let's say you're a brother and sister and your dad wrote your sister out the will and you thought that was unfair, you know, you're not obliged to take all the money. You could just agree, yeah, that's unfair, wasn't it, and just change the will. You can give money back from a will. You don't have to receive money. Another thing that a lot of people don't know is that you can change your will after someone's died. If you're the beneficiary, as long as all the people affected by the decision agree, you can do a deed of variation, it's called, which might apportion the money slightly differently. I mean, you might bypass you and go to your children for tax reasons. That might be a really good idea. So this is a question about rewriting a will and whether one needs to start from scratch each time. In the old days, people used to talk about codicils to wills. If you had a very, very complex will that ran into 20 pages and you had to write it all with a feather pen or something, you know. And you just thought, I can't be bothered to do all those quilly, strange letters again. You just write, in clause 1A, part 1, I change 20,000 to 10,000. You know, so that's a codicil. Nowadays we have things called word processors.
Yes.
And you can just print out the will and do it all again. It's much quicker. I don't do codicils, really. I mean, unless there was a real reason not to mess with the will. There might be. People still do them. But they can be a bit more confusing because then you've got two documents to look at. They have to make sense with each other. Yes, this solicitor might charge you quite a lot. You know, chop around with wills. I'm not going to promote myself outrageously at this moment. But basically, shop around, you know. The question is about trusting people and the degree to which we can just use informal processes in order to enact our wishes. We can do that, but a solicitor would, or a will writer would, want to give you advice about that. The things to think about are, in that case, well, actually, if you gave directly to your sister, that would be chargeable to inheritance tax potentially, whereas if you gave it straight to the charities, it wouldn't. So there's an argument there for just giving it to the charities if you know who they are. Job done. You can also give it to people and have them appoint it to particular charities. It would be a matter of construction as to whether you'd really given it to her or really given it to the charities. It could be less confusing just to give it straight to the charities, but I won't judge the merits of that particular thing. On the other thing is that situations change so dramatically over the years. So, you know, you might feel that your loved one, your sister, your partner, they will do what you want, but they might go on living for 30 years after you've died. And things change dramatically. They get involved in whole new sets of relationships, which bring pressure, have their own dynamics. So wherever possible, I think it's best to be clear, if you can be clear. If you can't be clear, set up a clear trust, which then describes your wishes. But I don't wish to push that too far, and I have had cases where people have been absolutely adamant, this is what I want to do, I just want to give it to my wife, my husband, they'll do the best thing. And, well, that's absolutely fine, you can trust people. I would always say you can trust people, but solicitors are always very cautious, of course, because they don't want it to blow back in their face a bit later on. This is a question about life interest trusts and inheritance tax. If the life tenant is your spouse, when the trust is set up, there's no charge to inheritance tax. It's treated as a transfer between spouses. When they die, the property is treated as being in their estate. So it would be added to their estate, and potentially, if it went over the amounts, what's called the nil rate amount, that would be chargeable to inheritance tax. It's deemed to really belong to them for inheritance tax purposes. If the beneficiary was not your spouse, there might be a charge when it goes into the trust, depending on the size and value of the property. When you set up a trust, the trust itself, often if it's a life interest trust, it would just then be, again, regarded as belonging to that person for inheritance tax purposes. It's a bit more complicated than that. Other types of trust are subject to their own tax regime. They're like entities which attract tax. There's a whole thing I won't go into now. Yeah. The Scottish question. There are complex rules for when a will in one country is going to apply to the laws in that country. So the will still be valid, a valid will. But if you've moved, if you're domiciled in another jurisdiction, your tax treatment is going to be different. So then you've got legal and tax questions that are a bit complicated start to open up. But if you just move somewhere for a year, if you started living somewhere else, if you move to Canada, you're going to want to get a Canadian. Those are the sorts of things that if you do move, you need to ask a local solicitor to start looking into it for you, yeah. Inheritance tax is charged on the whole of your estate, whatever it consists of, added up into a value. So if your house and your cash and shares or whatever add up to $500,000, $325,000 is deducted, the remaining $175,000 would be charged. With inheritance tax on property, you get 10 years to pay it. You can pay it in smaller amounts. If it's cash, you pretty much have to lose part of that cash. It depends how it's written in the will as well as to where the tax falls. So if it's a £10,000 gift you get in a will, generally you get £10,000. You don't have to pay any tax on it, but it might be expressed as subject to tax. But the residue is always subject to the tax. It's a more complex area to work out exactly where the tax falls and on whom it falls, but generally it's the estate, it's the residue of the estate that has to pay the tax, has to come up with the tax. You usually pay in instalments over a 10-year period if you've got the money. So if it was £30,000, you pay £3,000 a year plus a bit of interest. Funeral arrangements, yeah. People put their funeral arrangements in a will because it's an opportunity to record whether you want to be buried, cremated, or where you want ashes scattered, or whether you want a Buddhist or a humanist or whatever service. Yeah, so that could all go in, but do bear in mind that your will might be discovered sometime after the event. It's a bit academic. Oh gosh, she wanted burial. So you best to write it and, you know, let people know what you want in another way, write it down. But you can write down in a sort of, you know, in as long hand as you wish what your wishes are outside of the will. Write your own letter, and I sometimes encourage people to think about if they want to buy a plot of land to be buried in, they could buy it in advance. You can buy funerals in advance. I go into that with people. Pensions are held in trusts, and it's usually discretionary as to what happens, formally speaking, but you tell the pension company, I'd like it to go to such and such person. It's completely outside of the will. If it defaulted back to your estate, it would go according to your will. Like if they said, well, we'll just give it to your estate, you don't want that to happen. I'm not sure how that would happen, but you know, you want to be careful that your pension money doesn't come back into your estate, because then it would be subject to inheritance tax. You can write to your pension company and tell them, look, if my mum's not alive, then please give it to this person or that charity. Yeah, so that's treated outside of the will. You don't have to do it through a solicitor, but it has to be done through a formal process. It's a legal document, and, you know, you can discover about how to do it online. And a lot of people will come to someone like me or a solicitor and say, help me do that, because I've never done it before. And, you know, you can get guidance on things, but you can do it yourself as well. There's a whole procedure for witnessing it and executing it properly, but you have to do that very carefully. It's not rocket science, but with a lot of legal documents, you do need to do it properly.